happening. If I could ask people to take their seats, we'd like to begin this morning's lecture. Thank you. So as I give the people a few moments, it's wonderful to see colleagues and alumni greeting each other. I'll ask you to take your seats. My name is Rosie Goldstein. I'm the Vice Principal for Research and International Relations here at McGill University. And it's my great pleasure to welcome you to the 2013 Beattie Memorial Lecture. This lecture is taking place, as you know, once again, in conjunction with Homecoming Weekend. And so I welcome all of you to this morning's lecture, but I especially welcome our alumni back to McGill and back to Montreal. Je vous souhaite la bienvenue à la conférence commémorative Beattie, un événement annuel très cher à l'Université de McGill. A little bit about the history of the Beattie Memorial Lecture. This lecture dates back to 1952, when McGill received a $100,000 gift from Dr. Henry Beattie. He gave this generous donation to establish a public lecture series in honor of his brother, Sir Edward Beattie, who was at that time the president of the Canadian Pacific Railway, or CPR. McGill was the logical home for the family to place this initiative. Sir Edward Beattie had served McGill as chancellor and chair of the Board of Governors for over two decades, from 1920 to 1943. The Beattie family, as some of you may know, has made a lasting impact at McGill, not only through this lecture series, but also through a series of student scholarships awarded in the name, again, of Sir Edward. Moreover, Sir Edward's former home, known today as Beattie Hall, houses the School of Communication, Sciences, and Disorders, which is celebrating its 50th anniversary, as it happens this year. From the beginning, the Beattie Memorial Lecture Series was intended to bring to the public top thinkers, innovators, and leaders to this university in the service of advancing scholarship at McGill and also in the broader Montreal community. Topics over the last several years have been broad and have covered sustainability, neuroscience, and microlending, to name a few. So we're very pleased today to welcome Professor Witold Rybczynski to be our 2013 Memorial Beattie Lecturer, to have him join the esteemed group of laureates who have given this lecture over the years. And I know I'm looking forward to, as I'm sure you are, for his lecture in a few moments. He will discuss the unique relationship architects have with our collective past. I want to take a moment to thank Professor Rybczynski for taking up this honor and agreeing to give a lecture today, and in particular to thank the School of Architecture for making his nomination and also for hosting the professor during his visit on campus, where he will also meet with students and others from the McGill community. So before he is formally introduced, I'm going to introduce our new principal and vice chancellor, Suzanne Fortier, and it's my great pleasure to call upon her to welcome our esteemed guest. Before I do, I want to take a few moments to introduce Professor Fortier herself. Professor Fortier holds 2 degrees from McGill, a Bachelor of Science and a PhD, making her our university's third alumnus to serve as its leader. And she too has come home to McGill, and we welcome her back very warmly. Before she returned to her alma mater, Professor Fortier was president of the Natural Sciences and Engineering Research Council of Canada, or NSERC, which is one of the country's main research funding bodies, as you likely know. That is where I first met Professor Fortier, and I can tell you she was a force in that role as president. She helped in that role to bolster the organization's capacity to support discovery research and Canada's ability to attract and retain the world's best students and professors. And this will make a lasting mark on the research landscape in Canada. Prior to her appointment with NSERC, Suzanne served as Vice Principal Research, as well as Vice Principal Academic, as well as a professor in the Department of Chemistry and School of Computing at Queen's University. As a researcher, Professor Fortier specializes in the development of mathematical and artificial intelligence methodologies for protein structure determination. She has authored or co-authored over 80 journal articles and received numerous awards, and I'll name just a few. The Clara Benson Award for Distinguished Contributions to Chemistry by a Woman, Communications and Information Technology Ontario's Entrepreneurship Award, and the Queen's University Distinguished Service Award, among others. She is also a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and an officer of France's National Order of Merit. Please join me in welcoming McGill's 17th principal and vice chancellor, Professor Suzanne Fortier.
Merci, Rosie. Good morning, bonjour. Bienvenue à ce bel événement durant la semaine de retrouvailles. Thank you so much for being with us for this conference and for the la conférence commémorative BT 2013. Many of you are here as part of Homecoming. Happy Homecoming. Bonne semaine de retrouvailles. As you may know, it's a very special homecoming for me, as I've just started in my new role just a little bit over a month ago. And it's a special homecoming because I'm here to stay. I'm not returning anywhere. This is where I'm going to be. It is my distinct pleasure and privilege to introduce our lecturer. Professor Witold Rybczynski is an author, architect, and scholar. Il est titulaire de deux diplômes de McGill, un baccalauréat en architecture de l'université obtenu en 1966 et une maîtrise en architecture obtenue en 1972. L'université lui a aussi décerné un doctorat honoris causa es science en 2002. Le professeur Rybczynski a enseigné à McGill de 1974 à 1993, puis à l'Université de Pennsylvanie de 1993 à 2012, où il est maintenant professeur émérite. A renowned expert on the subjects of housing, architecture and technology, he is the author of more than a dozen books, including Home, A Short History of an ID, a work that explores the notion of domestic comfort. And it's good to know that Home won the Q Spell Literary Prize for Nonfiction and the Prix Paul-Henri Lapointe from the Order of Architects of Quebec. Among his books also is A Clearing in the Distance, Frederick Law Olmsted and America in the 19th Century, a biography of the seminal architect that was awarded J. Anthony Lucas Prize. And finally, I'll mention just one more, How Architecture Works, A Humanist Toolkit, an introductory book of an introductory look at architecture that was published this month. Professor Rybczynski's work has appeared in the New York Times, the New York Review of Books, and The Atlantic, among other publications. And from 2004 to 2010, he was the architecture critic for the online magazine Slate. Professor Rybczynski is an honorary fellow of the American Institute of Architects and an honorary member of the American Society of Landscape Architects. And from 2004 to 2010, he served on the U.S. Commission of Fine Arts. He is the recipient of many awards and accolades, among them the Seaside Prize, the Vincent Scully Prize, the Institute Honors for Collaborative Achievement from the American Institute of Architects, and the President's Award from the American Institute of Architects of Pennsylvania. Accueillons ensemble le professeur Rybczynski.
The title of my lecture, The Architecture and the Passage of History, and I had my personal passage of history because when I was climbing up to the steps to this building, I realized I had last climbed them 50 years ago when this building was still a woman's residence and I was dating one of them. And I couldn't remember, there was a curfew. 10, 11, I can't remember the time, but I know that when you showed up, of course, 3 minutes before the curfew, and the steps were covered with couples smooching at the last minute under the gaze of Queen Victoria. Whoops. We didn't have Google then, but I discovered on Google that this statue is actually the work of Queen Victoria's fourth daughter, Princess Louise, who was an accomplished artist. She also happened to be the wife of the Governor General of Canada, and Lake Louise in the Rockies is named after her. The other name on this statue is that of Donald Smith. His initials are right there. And he was the donor of this building. Lord Strathcona was the head of the CPR and a large donor at the university. And he gave us $50,000, which I calculate is about $1.5 million today. But $1.5 million bought a lot more building then than it does today. And he hired Bruce Price, the American architect, to design the building. Bruce Price is a very famous architect, famous for all sorts of different buildings, but among them are the, this thing isn't working, the chateau buildings of the CPR, like the Chateau Frontenac in Quebec City. He also designed Windsor Station in Montreal and Vigier Station. Vigier Station was the suburban or the regional station for the CPR. It was Windsor Station was where you went if you were going out west, but if you were going east or into the eastern townships or anywhere in the area, you would go to Vigier Station. And Vigier Station was the first railroad station in Canada to have a hotel as part of it. Unfortunately, they made a mistake and put it in the wrong place because Montreal developed much further west than Vigier Station. So by 1935, the CPR decided they had to close the station. It really wasn't getting enough traffic. And the business center had moved much further west than they expected. And so they sold the building to the city, which proceeded to gut it and turn it into offices. And it was as offices that it survived for many years. I think the city planning office was there when I was a student at McGill. Eventually, it was sold to a Dutch developer who wanted to turn it into condominiums. He went bankrupt, as developers often do, and sold it to another developer who hopefully will succeed in turning it into a condominium. And so people will be living there, hopefully, in a few number of years. So Vigier Station has had this long life, and it's worth reminding ourselves how unusual that is, because if you wanted to see a 1898 Winton, which was a car manufactured in Cleveland in the United States, one of the early production line cars, you have to go to a museum. And if you go to a museum, you don't get to drive one, you just look at it. Whereas here we have a building from 1898. If you want to see it, you just walk down the street. Our city, of course, is full of old buildings. And they're not in museums, and they're not museum pieces. We live in them, we work in them, we play in them, we go to conferences in them. So architecture is very unusual. It's one of the few artifacts which is as old as a century or more, many centuries if we're talking about Europe, which is used, which is not simply an antique. And that has a big effect on architecture. For one thing, architecture hangs around a lot. If you're a car designer, the cars get put away in museums, and you're always designing new cars. And you're never competing with the old cars. And if you're a plane designer, you're not competing with the Zeppelin or the Stratocruiser or any of those beautiful old ways of getting around. Everything's new, but in buildings it isn't. Buildings hang around a long time, and so architects are surrounded by the achievements of their predecessors. They're not hidden away, and they're not treated specially. It's always very sad to see a building turned into, for instance, a house museum, because nobody's living in it anymore. It's just there, and buildings have to be used. When buildings are used, that's what they're there for. Architecture is a practical art. It's not only to look at, it's to use. And a building that's being used is fulfilling itself, even if it's being used in a different way than the original architect planned or intended. So architecture, buildings, are unusual because they exist in many dimensions of time. Every building exists in the present. no matter how old it is. Buildings are only new for a split second, and then buildings get old, and then they get very old, and then they get ancient, but they're still there. And if we love them enough, we take care of them, and we maintain them, and we find other uses for them, and we fix them up and keep them going. Conversely, if we don't like them, we let them fall apart and we demolish them. And the present is important. Think of the Chateau Frontenac. It's an icon for the city of Quebec. When you go and stay there, you're just staying in a beautiful hotel. Maybe you think about Churchill and Roosevelt staying there. Maybe you think about the great days of Canadian railroads when they could build such beautiful buildings. Those days are long gone. They build ugly buildings today. Or maybe you just think of fairy tale castles and buildings that this was based on. Maybe it reminds you of Walt Disney's castle or something from Hans Christian Andersen. So all buildings live in the present. They also live in their own time. They're from a time, from the time they were built. But they also are from the historic past, and I'll explain that later in the talk. But most buildings refer to other things that precede them, earlier buildings. And so what makes architecture, I think, so fascinating is these layers of time. It's not like an appliance, you know, that you use and then you throw it away because it means nothing. Architecture means a lot to us, and as it gets older and as it ages, it means more and more, and we may forget when a building was built, but we may remember that the chateau looks fanciful, and it reminds us of a French chateau. I thought I'd start with this building, and I noticed it was on the very first slide, because it is such an icon for the university. It's our first building, so that any building that you build first, it was the first home of the university, would be important. We got lucky with this one, because it's also a beautiful work of architecture. And it's, of course, it stands in the center on the spine of the entrance of the university, so it occupies a position. And as I'll show you, it also resonates in many interesting ways with history. It was designed in 1830. It took a long time to build. I realized that the Board of Governors must have been all really cheap Scotsmen, and they were very careful with their money, and I think we should thank them for that, because the university has survived so long in part because of that kind of prudence. So we didn't charge ahead, throw all our money in the building, and then have nothing left over for books and pencils. We built it extremely slowly over these various sort of building initiatives. This is John Austell's design. He was the architect of this building. We don't know a lot about his early life. He was English. He came here as a young man. He must have had some training in England, but we don't really know what it was. Did he apprentice with somebody, which is what architects normally did? He set up as a surveyor here, so he at least understood surveying enough to do it as a business, but he was also a pretty handy architect. This was a competition. The McGill held a competition. There were three entries, and he won, and this is the drawing, his drawing of what he envisaged, which was this central bigger building and then arms and then other buildings. The idea was not original. This, if you look at the Horse Guards in London, it's a building of that sort of composition. It's the Palladian revival, which took ideas from Palladio in Italy and then transformed them through Inigo Jones and then eventually in the 18th century through the work of people like William Kent. And you see there's a central pavilion, there's sort of flanking wings, and then there's two pavilions at each end. So he would have known certainly this building in Whitehall coming from London. The central porch came from Palladio himself. Palladio designed many villas in the end of the Renaissance in Italy, and he came up with the idea of the two-story portico, which is very impressive because instead of just having one level of columns, you have two, and it sort of looks quite grand, and clearly Austell was influenced by having seen drawings. I don't think he went to Italy, but he would have seen there were many books of Palladio's work. And so we have the building in 1875, pretty much complete. You can't tell from this photograph, but the central portico, you can see it's only one story high, so they weren't springing for two stories. I don't know if they were planning to make it taller later, but it's built out of wood. It would have been the most expensive architectural feature of that building, and so the Board of Governors said, no, let's do it out of wood. Maybe they wanted to see what it looked like, or maybe it was just a question of cost. And for a number of years, for actually close to 50 years, there was a wooden portico there. So by the time the portico was finally built in stone, which is what it is today, it's 1925, and Fanshawe and MacDougall build the portico, and they don't try to replicate Austell's design, so it's a one-story version rather than a two-story version. Austell's idea for the building, and I think why it's so iconic, is that it's a very simple idea, and a lot of architecture is most successful when it starts with something extremely simple. John Summerson, the great British historian, once said that classical architecture is very hard to design well, but it's very easy to understand. And this building is very easy to understand because it has a temple, which is the Greek temple at the bottom, the portico, and it has a lantern, which is the cupola sticking up, which is what you see from a distance. So it's a building where you see the lantern from a distance, and then you get closer, and then you see the portico, and the two are related, although they come, as you'll see, from very different sources. It's a very small, modest portico. Temples never had only four columns. They always had at least six columns and usually more. But it does remind us of a Greek temple. This is a real Greek temple. The Temple of Hephaestus was actually the model for this building, which Austell might have known, which is Royal High School in Edinburgh, which is directly a version of that Greek temple. And again, it's the same sort of composition, wings, two pavilions at the end, and then a more important pavilion in the middle. We know that Austell traveled, so he may have gone to Philadelphia and seen the Second Bank of the United States, which is another Greek Revival building based on the Doric order. Happens to be an office building. It's the Second Bank of the United States. But it was one of the most prominent Greek Revival buildings of that period. The other element is the cupola, the lantern on top. And that comes from the Renaissance. The Romans built the Pantheon, which was the first building with the idea of a dome with a hole in the ceiling and light coming down, which was an extremely effective thing. So the Christians, when they started building churches, took that idea. But Christianity, of course, looks upward to heaven. I don't sure where the Romans looked, but they didn't feel the need to have that verticality that, say, Gothic cathedrals had. So when Brunelleschi built the dome, which is in many ways a classical Roman dome, although given a Gothic proportion, he put a lantern on top of it to give it a little more uplift, to kind of give you something. It would be more visible from far, and it doesn't end with a dome. And that became very much a tradition. So the light would enter through that lantern and light the inside of the church. Here's Christopher Wren at St. Paul's, and he turns the lantern into a little kind of building. But it still has that, it carries the cross, it gives the height to the building. Gothic buildings, of course, were very tall. St. Paul's had been destroyed by the fire of London. Wren is replacing it, but he needs the height. And so this lantern is extremely tall. It's like a small church spire on top. Oh, thank you. The Horse Guards has a cupola. By now, the lantern or cupola has become just a feature of a building. People like it. You can see it from far away. This one doesn't light a dome. It doesn't, as far as I know, it doesn't light any special room. It's really there to give a center to the building. You can put a clock on it, which is convenient. But it gives a kind of compositional uplift to the building, and you have this cupola in the center. And even in Mount Vernon, designed by George Washington, the cupola also is not there to bring light in primarily. It's really there to center the building and give it a little more importance. I mean, he is the President of the United States. Many people visited him at Mount Vernon. And this turns what is actually quite a modest house, not a very grand house. Washington was not as grand in his ambitions as somebody like Jefferson, but the cupola makes it important. It gives you the sense, this is something, I've come somewhere important in arriving here. So the building has sending us many messages. It's telling us about classical culture and that this is a place of learning, and it's looking back to the ancient world. There's a beacon of light. Cupolas are always attractive because at night they shine, and they are like lanterns. You can see it from a great distance. It becomes a symbol, you know, for 100 years or more of the university itself. And it resonates with the past as much as with the present. So when we look at that building today, we're looking at a 100-year-old building, but we're also looking at Greek temples and lanterns, and we're thinking of the Renaissance and Christopher Wren. It's all mixed in there. It was also a building of the so-called Palladian Revival. So British architects were looking back at Palladio, the Renaissance architect in Italy, and he was looking back at the Romans. So it was really a kind of revival of a revival. And then Austell takes those ideas and introduces them to the colonies. It's kind of a little bit old-fashioned by then, but of course it's new as far as Montreal is concerned. Robert Adam is a contemporary British architect, and he gives a very good definition of a revival, which is when an architect wants to remind people of some past period for some reason. And the important thing is not how accurate the revival is or whether it's very complete. Gothic revival building doesn't have to be Chartres Cathedral, you know, in every detail. It can just be a pointed window and you say, oh, Gothic, even though there's no other detail. So revival is a revival whether or not it's accurate or historical or archaeological or any of those things. The last Gothic cathedral generally accepted is in the end of the 13th century. And then Gothic sort of slips away and gets replaced eventually by the Renaissance. But Gothic never really goes away. So in Spain and Portugal, Gothic buildings are built well into the 16th century, and it becomes a much more decorated, elaborated sort of Gothic than in Northern Europe. The Venetians loved Gothic. They never stopped liking Gothic. And so you get domestic buildings, which have nothing to do with religion at all, using the Gothic style in a sort of extravagant way. So the pointed arches go up, then they come down, and they become these funny scissor things. It's really about the decoration, and this is the Cadoro, but there are many, many Gothic buildings, the Ducal Palace in Venice. In 1577, they had a really bad fire, and most of it was destroyed. And there was a big debate in Venice, how should we replace it? Because maybe we should put something new. That's what we would do. But the Venetians said, no, rebuild it exactly as it is. So what we're looking at is actually from 1577. It's not the original building. They simply duplicated it, not because they were historic preservationists. They simply liked it. And they weren't really keen on Palladio's classicism. It was too severe. It was kind of abstract. They liked the colors of Venetian Gothic. They liked the shapes, all the decoration. That appealed to them a great deal. Christopher Wren is best known for introducing classical architecture to England. And all his churches that he built after the Great Fire are classic buildings, except this one. And this is a Gothic building. It was the lady who gave the money for this reconstruction said, I'm giving you the money, but it has to be Gothic. I love the old church. You have to do the same thing. So Wren did sort of Gothic. It's a very original interpretation. It's not a copy of Gothic. The arches are very flat. They're not sharp and pointed. The ceiling is plaster. It's not a wooden fan vault ceiling. It's a plaster fan vault ceiling. So it's not a historical reproduction. It's really Wren's imagination as a great architect coming through, but working with this different language. And he did some other buildings. He did a famous building at Cambridge, where he said he was asked to do a little gateway tower. And he said, well, the founders of the college wanted Gothic, so we should respect that. And he built this Gothic Tom Tower, which is a very weird Wren Gothic, but it is Gothic, except it's translated through the imagination of this exceptional architect. One of the first Gothic revivals was led by Horace Walpole, who was a writer, and this is his house. And so he's turning Gothic into a totally secular style. And they're very fanciful. You can't find any medieval buildings that actually look like this. And it's, of course, a house, so it's not rather large English country house. But the first Gothic revival in England was very much tied to literature and the imagination and the love of the picturesque and looking back at old England. I mean, there were all these things resonating in it. Augustus Welby Pugin, on the other hand, was a devout Catholic, and he saw Gothic in a sort of moral way. For him, it was the right way to build. And he was very influenced by somebody like John Ruskin. And so he's using Gothic as very much as a religious style. He built primarily churches in this style. On the other hand, when it comes to the United States, to North America, it adopts a much more secular appearance. And here's a famous house by Alexander Jackson Davis, which uses Gothic in the way that Walpole did to create a large country house. It was about this time that we built the Parliament buildings in Ottawa. First of all, clearly a reflection of the Parliament buildings in Westminster. So the mother of all parliaments is there, so if you want to start a parliament, you should adopt their style. It's actually a very different style. It's a much more Victorian style, the original buildings. The tower is a replacement for a tower that burnt down, and it's a much more high Gothic sort of thing. But again, not so much it's called the Peace Tower because it represented the peace after the Great War, and it doesn't have to do with the religion. It really has to do with creating this big iconic symbol, putting a clock at the top, and creating essentially a landmark. And we'll come back to this in a more contemporary building later on. The tallest Gothic tower was the Woolworth Building, which was the tallest skyscraper in the world in 1913, and which used the verticality of Gothic to organize a very tall building. So there was a kind of confluence. Cass Gilbert was not a Gothicist. This is one of the very few Gothic buildings he did. He loved Beaux-Arts classicism, and that's what he did. The U.S. Supreme Court is one of his buildings. But he realized that it was very hard to, you couldn't just pile columns up for 70 or 80 floors. I forget how tall this building is. Whereas Gothic allows you to have pinnacles and steeples and it did have this funny connotation. It was often called the Cathedral of Commerce because Frank Woolworth, of course, was the five-and-dime store magnate. If you ever go to New York, you should go to the lobby. It's a wonderful lobby with gargoyles, which are actually pictures of Frank Woolworth and Cass Gilbert and other people who worked on the building. So there was a kind of sense of fun about it, I think, from Gilbert's side. The other application of Gothic, which what became very durable, was collegiate Gothic. And here's a building by Ralph Adams Cram at Princeton. He was the university architect for a number of years and established, or I should say reestablished, the Gothic style for that campus. This obviously is a reference to Oxford and Cambridge and the old buildings of Oxford and Cambridge, or at least it starts that way. By the middle of the 20th century, for most Americans, it's simply a nice campus. That's what a campus should do. It should have ivy, and the ivy should be growing on Gothic quadrangles with towers, and it should all be kind of picturesque because it's not a great formal style. And many, many American campuses and some Canadian adopted this style. Toronto is not a Gothic campus, but it does have Gothic revival buildings. This is a very early one, Hart House, which again uses there's always a steeple, which maybe there are bells in it, but it's essentially a landmark feature to break up the horizontality. It's a very attractive style because you can build very large dormitories, for instance, that don't look bureaucratic and authoritarian because you can break them up with windows and the composition. That's always a challenge if you go to Bishop Mountain Hall, for instance. That's a bureaucratic residence. It looks like glorified Holiday Inn, excuse me. I lived there for a year, so I speak from personal experience. I would have much rather lived in this building. I think one of the nicest Gothic revival buildings at McGill is Divinity Hall, now the Burks Building, which was built as a Divinity Hall. So there the Gothic did have these overtones of religion and Protestantism. I forget which particular sect this was. And this is Harold Fonshaw, the same architect who did the porch, the final porch on the arts building. And this is a kind of a tougher Gothic. It's an earlier Gothic. It's less about a lot of filigree. It's quite different from Venetian Gothic. It's a kind of northern cold Presbyterian Gothic, but it has a wonderful kind of toughness to it that I really like. University stopped building Gothic Revival buildings for at least 50 years or so, and then they realized, why stop? They weren't very happy with those 50 years of architectural production, and the campuses, particularly the ones that had a lot of Gothic Revival buildings, felt that they were losing touch with their roots and that they ought to reconnect. And so you have Whitman College in Princeton, which is designed in 2007, in a Gothic Revival style. And so it's a Gothic Revival of a Gothic Revival. So Cram does it first in 1913, and then Porfirios does it again in 2007. A campus that is very consistently Gothic is University of Notre Dame, probably because of the religious connection, and maybe priesthoods are better at pushing architects around, so they never let the architects come in and put high-rise buildings on their campus. They kept that Gothic feeling. And here's Robert Stern in 2013, with a kind of simplified Gothic, but clearly identifiable as Gothic building. And Stern is designing two colleges at Yale, the first colleges they built, I think, since the ones that Eero Saarinen designed in the 60s. And they're both in a very high Gothic style. Their construction has just started, so it'll be interesting to see what the result will be, because this is a very large project. Yale, of course, is a very prominent university. Stern is a very competent architect, so it may have a very big influence on other universities, particularly other university presidents who realize that, yes, you could build a Gothic building in 2013. Somebody asked Stern once, was he trying to replicate the style of Gothic architecture? And this was his answer, and I think it's a good one, that not to replicate, but to speak. He sees architecture as a language, and Gothic architecture has a language of forms and shapes and proportions. And he's trying to use the language, but saying something new with it. And he compares it to the English language. We don't feel that we're copying Shakespeare just because we speak proper English. We often use quotes from Shakespeare. I mean, we have a connection. Language is a wonderful connection to the past because it includes all the books of the past or part of the present, because you can read them and you can go to a Shakespeare play. And so there's this constant flow, much as in architecture, between the past and the present. I wanted to show you three buildings by contemporary architects, because there are revival architects like Robert Stern and Porfirios who are using the language in a very complete way. But I think even modern architects, if they're good, make references to the past and find ways to connect to the past, even though they may not do it in quite as literal a way. And one of the buildings I want to show you is the Canadian Center for Architecture, which of course embraces the past quite literally, since there's this old Victorian building. But Peter Rose didn't feel that he should adopt a high Victorian style for his building, which is probably just as well, because it's not a great style, in my opinion. It's a kind of mishmash of historical forms. But it's an interesting juxtaposition between the old and the new here. But his building does look back, not to Victorian Montreal, but rather to the beginnings of architecture. And I've never spoken to him about this, and I'm not sure how intentional this was, but this is a museum of architecture. And so one way of approaching it, as he did, was to try to make a connection with the beginnings of modern architecture, which is the very beginning of the 20th century. And if you go to the CCA, when it was first built, I wondered what that walkway was, because it's sort of like a walkway for window washers, except there are no windows. And it looks kind of functional. It looks like it would support somebody. It's a catwalk. And yet, what actually is it? And it was only later, when I looked at the work of Otto Wagner, that I realized what it is a reference to this time. It's Rose trying to use some of the language from this beautiful building, the American Austrian Postal Savings Bank by Otto Wagner in Vienna, which is a very interesting moment when architects who are trained as traditional architects start to develop a modern sensibility, but they're not giving up the connection to the past. So this building uses symmetry, it uses traditional relationships. These are almost columns there, but they're not, they're so abstracted they don't really look like classical columns. But there's a connection to the past. It's much more interesting, I think, than later when architects decide the past is forbidden territory and they just ignore it. Somebody like Wagner is really trying to do both. That's why he's such an interesting architect. And if you look at this, he has this kind of strange cornice at the top of his building, which is sort of like the walkway at the top of Peter Rose's building. He also has bolts kind of attaching thin sheets of stone to it. It's this funny mixture of a traditional building and an old building. Peter Rose did not include any statues in his building. I've always thought that was a shame because you could have Phyllis at the top of the CCA building holding a book and maybe a T-square. Statues on top of buildings date back to the Renaissance. As far as I found out, Palladio was one of the first architects who had this idea of putting human figures on tops of buildings, which, if you think about it, is a very strange idea, like putting a statue on the roof. And I realized one of the things it does is that it humanizes the building. It says there are people in this building, don't forget, and they're more important than the architecture, so they're going to stand right on top. And it gives us something to look at the top of a building, but I think it turns the building into something more human in an odd way. There's a beautiful hall inside Wagner's building, and if we look at Peter Rose's building, the entrance has some of that feeling. He also does something in the entrance which comes from Palladio and the architects of his day, which is that wall in wood at the back looks like stone, but it's actually plywood, but laid up like a coursework in stone. And Palladio used to do that because he wanted to build stone buildings, but his clients never had enough money, so they only built brick buildings and plastered them. But then he would have the joints painted onto the plaster so it looked like a stone building. Not to make it fake, but to sort of remind you that this is, really he wanted to build a building like the Romans did out of solid stone, but he couldn't quite make it. And this was a big budget building. They could have used whatever they wanted, but it sort of, gives you this interesting, it's wood and yet it looks like stone, so you're reminded of stone, but you know it's wood, and if you touch it, it's hollow. I mean, it makes the building kind of have a whole layer of meaning that's much more interesting. The second building is the National Gallery in Ottawa by Moshe Safdie in 1986. It has, of course, this famous glass hall in the middle. And the hall is a very literal connection to the Library of Parliament, which is just across the Rideau Canal, which is this beautiful chapter house, Gothic chapter house, which houses the library, which was burnt and I forget, rebuilt, one of the last parts of the Houses of Parliament to be rebuilt. But Safdie wanted to make a connection with, and he did something very unusual, which was to sort of mimic the form in glass and steel. It's a different use. He's not literally trying to mimic the form, but he is, if we look here, he does have things that are sort of like flying buttresses, and there's a verticality to his building which I think connects to the Gothic buildings, as you'll see in a minute, on both sides of him. And he's doing also something which connects you, and you say, oh, government and art. I mean, I think only in Canada would you ever have that juxtaposition. Mostly it's government and power or government and money. But here we have government and art. And the two buildings make you think of that, I think. At the other end of the National Gallery is Notre Dame Basilica, which is a Gothic Revival building, which also then connects to his building more in the sense of being a good neighbor, perhaps. So Safdie could have done a glass box, but I think he would have lost something in the process. It might have been just as good a museum once you were in it, but it wouldn't resonate with the buildings in quite this way. And certainly Safdie is not a historicist architect by any means, but I think this site kind of pushed him in that direction. There are some other resonances with the less distant past. Any architect who sees the galleries in the National Gallery will immediately think of Louis Kahn and the Kimball Art Museum, and of course, Softy worked for Kahn for a year. I was very aware this is one of the most famous museums of the 20th century. And so using that shape and lighting it from the top is a kind of relationship and makes you think of that, and it's looking back at this famous architect. But of course, both of them are actually looking back at much older art galleries. So the idea of an art gallery with a vaulted ceiling and light from the top, which then bounces down the vault in a nice way, goes back to the 19th century, and this is in the Vatican in Rome. So both of them, when you go into an art gallery and you're seeing a vault like this, it feels very familiar because you've seen it in many, many galleries, old galleries, new galleries, and you know where you are. You know this is a place where they can show art, even if it's a very modern building. And finally, the National Gallery has a couple of spaces which are not for art. They're sort of landscape, there's water in one of them. They're really places where, like a decompression place, where you can get away from the art. There's cushions and places to sit here. And it's simply a relaxing place. In a very large museum, the biggest problem is fatigue. People just get tired and then they rush through and don't want to get out. And this is a place where you can just stop. And this was an idea which Softy really took from John Russell Pope in the National Gallery of Art in Washington. There are two beautiful sort of greenhouses full, very lush, full of, one of them's a restaurant today, I think, but full of plants and a fountain inside. No art, just places to relax and sit and talk and do whatever you want. Pope invented this. He didn't take this from anywhere. I mean, he was designing an extremely large museum for the National Gallery in D.C., and he just needed spaces that were not just a rabbit warren of galleries, but he needed to organize it in some way. And there's one at each end, so you know where you are. It's a big help in orienting people in the building. And the final building is by Bing Tom, more recent building in Surrey, B.C., and you might say, well, what on earth does this have to do with anything in the past that looks so unusual and original? And yet it seemed to me that these shapes that Tom is using have a lot to do with the early expressionist architecture of the early 1900s, especially Eric Mendelssohn, a very talented German architect of that period, and particularly many sketches that Mendelssohn did of these imagined buildings, which would be all curves. These were not commissions. They were a lot of these he did during the First World War just to fill up the time when he was a soldier in the trenches. And they're tiny drawings, and they're sort of an idea of something. And I think Tom's building, in a way, is a kind of representation of that. The inside of the building is essentially one large space with a ramp around it. And again, anybody who goes to museums immediately thinks of the Guggenheim Museum. These floors are not ramped, so it's a little more sensible than having all the floors sloping. But the feeling of the inside is very much of a space with this great big ramp leading you down or up, where everything is open to everything else. The Surrey Library is a neighborhood library, so it's not a library with scholars that need a lot of silence. So it's a kind of lively neighborhood place, mostly full of children. So having this one big space is actually very nice. The great British architect James Stirling once said that architects have always looked back in order to move forward. And that's what I've been showing you, how architects take history, because they're surrounded by history, because all the old buildings mostly are still there if they haven't been destroyed, and you're always looking at them. And architects go on tours all the time, travel. They go with a sketchbook, they go with a camera, because you have to look at all those things. That's your inheritance. And it's doctors don't study how did doctors operate 100 years ago. I mean, who cares? And God forbid they should ever do that again. So that's not interesting to a doctor. But to an architect, how architects built 100 years ago is not just interesting, it's crucial, because that's the canon. That's what architecture is. It's the next step builds on that in some way, sometimes literally, like a revival, sometimes not so literally. So have architects haven't always looked back. I mean, there are architects who don't look back. This is Zaha Hadid in Baku, Azerbaijan, not a place I'm likely to ever visit. But this is a building that clearly doesn't look back. And we say, that's fresh, that's visionary, isn't that great? Well, maybe. But what about 100 years from now? You know, will this building, well, it won't be fresh anymore because the way she builds it may or may not be standing up very well. But it will not resonate with anything except itself. It will say, this is what we did in 2013. But it won't tell us anything else about ourselves, I think. I couldn't resist adding this. I don't. Some of the older people may remember the Futuro house was designed by a Finnish architect in the 1960s. It was a fiberglass house which was delivered by helicopter, and it was like the science fiction house of the future. And when we look at it 50 years later, it doesn't look so great to me. It's more like the hula hoop or some fad from a time that's kind of interesting, it's sort of curious, but not really profound in any way. And I think visionary architecture has that great danger or risk that an idea of the future, in the future, can look either funny or sad or just boring. So why do architects look back, or why have so many architects look back so often? I think there are a number of reasons. I think admiration is one. H.H. Richardson, the great American architect, loved Romanesque architecture. I mean, he used to travel every summer and take pictures of Romanesque churches. He just liked it a lot. He thought it was a wonderful thing. And his architecture brings in so many motifs from the Romanesque. There's sometimes a sense of rediscovery. Something has been ignored for years, and suddenly we rediscover it. And we feel that this is something that people should know about, that is part of our heritage, that why not? I thought of Windsor Station is ripe for rediscovery. It's a wonderful building, but it obviously hasn't influenced Montreal. I took it for granted. I used to go through there to catch trains. It was just a building in Montreal. I didn't think of it as great architecture. I sort of took it for granted. But one day, maybe a Montreal architect will rediscover Bruce Price and say, wow, look what we have here. We can learn something about architecture from this. There's a sense of old virtues. They did things better than we do, or they were more honest than we are, or they were more capable than we are. So there are moments like that in architecture. Sometimes, like Stern at Yale, it's a matter of fitting in. We've got all this beautiful Gothic Revival architecture. Why do we need to reinvent something? I mean, there are plenty of new buildings in other places, but in this place, why don't we just keep going? Sometimes old architecture inspires architects. And they, as probably it did in the case of Safdie in Ottawa, he got inspired, and why don't I try to do this? But I'm going to do it in glass and steel, and I'm going to have sunshades inside. And I mean, it's a totally different experience. And yet you feel that the original inspiration must have come from the Parliamentary Library. And sometimes it's just a matter of taste. I don't like Victorian architecture. But somebody in the future might like it. So tastes change. People ignored Gothic architecture for a long time. The Gothic revival happened for one amongst other reasons is that tastes changed and people rediscovered these buildings, which were all still there. The Gothic cathedrals were there throughout the Renaissance. We just ignored them. They were just the old buildings, you know, the old stuff that our great-great-grandparents did, but it wasn't something we looked at. And Montreal has, I think, arguably the best collection of Art Deco buildings in North America. When I was growing up here, I never even looked at them. I wasn't aware of them because I was interested in modern architecture, and there was very little of that. But that was my focus, and I didn't realize, you know, that Eaton's and Holt Renfrew, and that we had more of it, mainly because we didn't have as bad a depression as the Americans. So the Americans, Art Deco in Miami Beach is really kind of flaky. It's just plaster and colored paint. Our Art Deco is stone, and it's really solid and real and very, very interesting. I mean, we have the whole University of Montreal campus. It's just an amazing place. But tastes changed, and we kind of ignored that architecture for a long time. Finally, there's a sense of comfort in connecting to the past. And I want to close on with a quote from somebody who gave this lecture in 1961, not about architecture, and I don't. Arguably, the quote isn't really about architecture. It's Arnold Toynbee, and this is a quote from one of his books. And he was a young man, he's recounting being a young man walking around London in 1920 or so, just after the First World War. And he has this kind of spiritual experience. He's walking by an old stone wall, and I don't know what prompts it, and he doesn't explain what prompts it. But he has this sort of semi-mystical experience where he feels suddenly a part of history. History is part of him. He's part of history. We're only, all of us, just little bits of history. And I think it's comforting to see ourselves in a longer spectrum than just today, and that all that's important is today, and when that goes, it's gone. It's much more interesting and comforting to feel that our part in history had a previous history, and that there's previous history in our buildings, and our buildings 100 years from now will inform people also to have some connection. As he says, he feels the passage of history, which was where I found the lecture title, gently flowing through him in a mighty current, and of his own life welling like a wave in the flow of this vast tide. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Vitor. It really, this unique ability of Vitor to make us all feel comfortable, but it's make us feel at home. And he comes back home and teaches us our own history. It's quite remarkable of key buildings through which we walk, through which we kind of lead our daily lives, but have never thought about how it came about, who built it. And this ability has really not just, he's not, excuse the expression, sucking up to his old alma mater here, but it is his ability to think about architecture, buildings, communities and cities, and challenge our profession and professionals to come and look back. This is what has made Vitor one of the most successful persons in bringing our profession to another level. Not a clubby thing, but a vocation, a broad vocation. And thank you very much for that discourse. Professor Rybczynski has agreed to answer some of the questions. There are microphones at top and bottom, but if we can move around, they are portable microphones, so that would be the best way to
You've suggested that buildings are to be used at present while connecting us with our roots. But this raises questions as to who is to use the buildings and whose lives are being remembered. Surely, historically, we know that the vast majority of humanity lived and worked under terrible conditions, and whose lives have largely been forgotten. So the question arises, can this be changed? And how? How can we make the lives of more people more meaningful than just simply empty ciphers?
I think public buildings, in a sense, belong to everybody. Whether you actually go into the building or use it, you pass by it on the street if it's an urban building, and it's simply part of your life. So I think architecture has always had this role, no matter who built it. Buildings are expensive, and architects work for the wealthy and the powerful, traditionally. And until very recently, with the rise of large nation states, that was the case. So architects, the client list was always the Pope or a bishop or an aristocrat or a very wealthy person. And certainly historically that's true, and that's still true to some extent today. But the result of that work, you know, the Pantheon is a building that the public can go into. It's part of your life. And so I see architecture, no matter how it starts, does have this public role. And so that's how I see the connection with the man in the street, so to speak. He enjoys those buildings, he looks at them. In my book, I at the beginning of the book, I mentioned that the Gothic Cathedral was not built for architecture critics or conoscenti of any sort. It was built for the man in the street who could, you know, could gape at it. They had all these gargoyles, and the stained glass windows were kind of stories of saints and martyrs and so on. And so the whole cathedral is a way of communicating to people at that point who are probably illiterate and who are impressed by the size of the building. They're impressed by the acoustics, because then people sing inside and you've got these great spaces. So architecture, there is I would admit, a kind of contradiction that rich people build it, but then we all get to enjoy it. There are certainly exceptions to that. I was looking on the internet the other day at one of the Russian oligarch's yachts. I'll probably never see it or enjoy it, even from a distance. And there are certainly a whole layer of private architecture, country houses, private residences, palaces, which remain private. But so much of architecture is in the public sphere that, in a sense, whatever the motivation, whatever the architect or his client was thinking, it becomes part of the public realm. Even a building like the Woolworth Building, which is, after all, a commercial building built by a millionaire, in a sense, to celebrate his success, has now become simply a part of the New York skyline. And many people wouldn't remember Woolworth. I think the store chain has disappeared. They don't remember who Woolworth was, but they know that building on the skyline. So I think architecture sort of translates beyond the original motivations of the people who built it and becomes part of our world.
Thank you.
Vito, another question.
Where's?
Over here. Oh. How are you?
One thing occurred to me that you didn't touch upon, which I found surprising in its absence, and I was looking back, you didn't talk about circulation and how modern architecture, it does in fact sometimes pick up very good elements of circulation, other than, say, Bob Stern was a little more of a pastiche, or you go to an extreme where you show some of Zaha's work and you go to the Maxi Museum in Rome and it's all circulation and very little gallery space. But you haven't traced for us in modern architecture, in certain buildings, maybe Raphael Maneo's, or even some of Peter Eisman's, or Richard Myers, how circulation and the clarity of circulation in historical buildings, classical and otherwise, may have infected and monitored and guided some of the good modern architecture today. Have you brought the circulation aspect, traced it back, and pulled it in any of the research?
I think of the three examples I showed, the National Gallery is the clearest one for circulation, because you enter you see the big glass pyramid shape, but there's a little one here, which is the entrance, and you enter that. And then there's a long ramp that takes you up to the big one. And Softee had a real problem, because changing levels is always a problem in architecture, and with ADA compliance, it becomes a real problem, because you can't have grand stairs anymore. And he created this very long ramp, which is actually a very nice experience because it's got glass on one side, so you can look at it and see things. It's very monumental. It's sort of like an Egyptian Cecil B. DeMille movie, this huge ramp. And it's also practical because that's where you queue up for these big blockbuster shows. There's a place. Most museums, of course, were designed before blockbuster shows, so you queue up in the basement or some horrible place. So I think that was a good example of using circulation to structure a building. I'm not sure. I think it's true that the classical architects, the traditional architects, tended to make circulation very evident. So they would put important things in the middle. You know, you always know where you are in an old school. There's a door for girls and a door for boys. There's a door in the center. In an old building, you always know if the men's room is on one side, the ladies' room must be on the other side. Modern architects tended not to do that. So modern buildings can be more confusing. I would agree if that was your point about circulation, because they often feel uncomfortable setting up simple axes, which is still the best way to get around a building. And I admire Renzo Piano a lot, and one of the reasons is that he accepts all those traditional planning arrangements. His building often have a major axis right down the center, and everything is there, and the door's in the middle of the building where it's supposed to be. God knows he's a modern architect. He's not interested in history from an architectural point of view at all, and yet he uses very traditional ways of organizing the building and getting you through it and keeping it very simple. His structure is often very complicated, and his details are complicated, but the motion through the building is very simple. So he would be a good example, I think, of a modern architect who does organize the building around circulation. The aisle is in the middle. That's where you expect to see it. And part of that, I think, comes from the Renaissance. You know, we are symmetrical, unless we've had a terrible accident. We have two of everything, and so there's a way we relate, I think, to buildings in that way. We expect buildings to have a front and a back. And the front is the important part, where your face is. We call it a facade, and that's supposed to express something about a building. And we expect symmetry, more or less, or at least if we're given symmetry, we know what's going on. And so there are a lot of, I think, it's not about planning. It's also about sort of the humanist traditions that have guided architecture in all cultures. I mean, Chinese buildings are symmetrical. Indian buildings are largely symmetrical in their layout. So Islamic architecture uses symmetry. So symmetry is not something that comes from Paris. It comes, I think, and it's hard to prove, but I think it really does come from a kind of innate sense of how things ought to be done.
Piano's work were part of your submission, I think, just as an example. In your talk, you seem to imply that older buildings are just sort of left alone and people move on. But in reality, isn't there kind of a disdain for some of the older historical styles, and people can't be left alone and they tamper with it? I'm thinking of the Gothic cathedral in Geneva has this horrible colonnade classical front put onto it. How do we, or should we, leave alone some of the architectural styles from the past? And I'm thinking of brutalism, which is really not very much loved architectural style today. Should we leave it alone, or should we feel free to tamper with it?
I think the buildings that people revere in some way are the buildings they're going to be the most careful about, and they will... nobody has, I'm sure, over the years ever suggested taking the arts building down or changing it in any radical way. At least they haven't successfully, and it's taken care of and it's maintained. It's such an important symbol of McGill itself, of the campus. And so the buildings that people like, it's a very good building. I didn't make that point maybe strong enough, but it's a very good work of architecture. It does everything that it's supposed to do, and it does it nicely. And it has, going up that stairs and, you know, where all those students were hanging around. It feels good. It has a lot of very positive qualities. So if you like a building, you're probably going to take care of it. I've studied this a little bit. There's a moment, usually it's like 30, 40 years after a building is built, where the fashions change. And that's the worst time for a building, because that's when it's easiest just to demolish it or to do something really insensitive to change it, which is just almost as bad. And so if a building can get through that 30, 40 years, then it's sort of, people will maintain it. The mechanics have to be changed. The uses change all the time, except maybe for certain religious buildings. So all of that has to be accommodated. And whether people take the trouble and spend the money to do it really ultimately depends on how much they like the building. It's, I think, more emotional than anything else. And taste certainly plays a role. Some buildings never go out of fashion. And so there's always a sense that these are important buildings. The U.S. Capitol, I think, has always been considered an important symbol, the White House. But there are other styles that are less durable, and they sort of go up and down. And there are moments when people don't think it's very worthwhile saving it. They don't see the point. They think it's ugly. Sometimes it's eccentric architects whose work is sort of in fashion and out of fashion. And brutalism is a problem because nobody likes it, except a few architecture critics. But really nobody likes those heavy concrete buildings. They don't feel good. They smell bad because it's all concrete. They're rough to touch. They don't have attractive details that are somehow... this building is... okay. I don't think it's as good as the Chateau Frontenac. I mean, the Bruce Price's original building. But even, it's a very simplistic kind of organization, but it has nice details. So even if you don't think this is one of his great buildings, you can still enjoy the stonework and some of the little details that he's put in. Brutalist buildings don't give you anything. And that's, I think, is a challenge, because the public really doesn't like it. And if the public seriously doesn't like it, they're going to get demolished, like the one got demolished recently, one of Goldberg's buildings in Chicago. So it's hard to... You can stick up for them if you think they're so important. I don't think there's a rule that says we have to save every building of every moment of every period of the time. Otherwise, we live in a world like a Borges short story where nothing would ever be taken away and we would be overcome by old buildings. So I don't think it's about that. I think we save the ones we want to save. And sometimes it's economics. Sometimes nobody's ever going to tear down Place Bonaventure. It just costs too much. It's all concrete. So even if people think, wouldn't it be nice if it was not there, or we have a better idea, whatever the rationale would be, that's just a very expensive building to demolish. So it's unlikely to be demolished. But in other cases, I think if you can't summon up public support for a building, the argument that it's important just because it represents a period is not a strong one, in my opinion.
We seem to be in the speaker's corner here. I'd be curious to get your take on a recent kind of revival, which you didn't mention, something called postmodernism. What do you make of that exactly? Because wasn't that a really revival gone extremely wrong?
I'm an admirer of Charles Moore and Robert Venturi. I think they're both really serious, interesting architects. Postmodernism is kind of like the opposite of the quote I told you. Summerson said that classicism was very hard to do well, and the problem was postmodernism was very easy to do, and so too many people did it, and there were no rules about how you did it, and the work that somebody like Venturi put into a building was not evident, and so people looked at it and said, oh, I can do that. I can make a pastiche. I can put a cartoonish shape on a building, but of course it wasn't done in any kind of thoughtful, considered way. It was thrown on. So I agree that it was a style where many people practiced it who were not very good at it or knowledgeable about history or what they were doing. But the fact that there's a revival is not surprising, because architecture is full of revivals. I mean, arguably, there's a revival going on all the time. Even Richard Meier is a kind of revival of early modernism. There's a revival of sort of 50s California modernism, you know, the skinny columns and kind of Mies on a diet. Which is it's an attractive style in many ways, and it suits us in many ways, because it's kind of relaxed, and revivals are part of the world of architecture. It's not an unusual thing to have a revival. It's more the norm, and the reason for a revival are usually sometimes architectural, but as I pointed out, sometimes cultural. People just start thinking of certain shapes, certain colors, certain period attracts them, and so it happens. I personally wasn't an admirer of most of the postmodern work, so I don't know what a revival would be like, but I don't think one can know what a talented architect would do with something like postmodernism. Was very interesting in its goal. It didn't achieve it a lot, but it really wanted to be modern and not modern at the same time. And that's an interesting aspiration, but very, very complicated, and I think too complicated for most of the architects who were doing it. But one of the architects that I like a lot is Paul Cray, who designed every night you see the U.S. Federal Reserve on television because there's some new crisis. And that's one of his buildings. And it's a building which is classical, but not classical. It has no classical ornament, and yet it has this balance of classical buildings. And unfortunately, it was a style which, for most people, is associated with Mussolini and Hitler, because they also adopted the style. They liked this kind of stripped classicism. And so it's probably going to be a long time before we have a revival, because it'll have to lose that connection, which is very strong in people's minds. Even though it was not invented by Mussolini's architects, and you can see some beautiful World War I memorials by Cray, which are in that style, which influenced the Nazis in their classical, stripped classicism. But that's an architect. He was an architect who was trying to be classical and modern at the same time, who accepted that we were living in a new world, but who didn't want to throw out all the old things, and who was trying to sort of do both at the same time. And of course, it was a particular moment, 1930, roughly. So postmodernism, I can sympathize with it, although, like you, I don't admire most of its work.
We have one question.
Yes.
Can you help us reconcile Louis Sullivan's dictum of form follows function with the pioneering work of Frank Gehry?
Well, form follows function was always a more of a belief of modernism than an actual fact of modernism. In architecture, form has never followed function. So why should it suddenly in 1920 be true is a puzzle. One of the great inventions of the Renaissance was the pilaster. And the pilaster is those flattened columns that you use. They have no structural function at all. They're not, but they look like a column. They look as if the wall was divided in with these columns, and they really are not about structure at all. And the history of architecture is full of things like that. I mean, the fan vault in a Gothic cathedral supports nothing. It's a very, very expensive suspended ceiling. It supports itself, which is something because it's stone. But the roof above is all wood. That's the real roof. The vaults are just an architectural idea. And, of course, they give an incredible quality to a Gothic cathedral because the architecture just envelops you. But yet it's not actually doing anything. It's just a heavy ceiling. So form follows function, I think, was never made a lot of sense. And I actually admire Frank Gehry, because I think in many ways he does try to. He's a sole case. I mean, he is, I think, a great architect. I think he's a terrible model for untalented architects to follow. But he is definitely a talented, great architect. And when you go to his buildings, there is a structure there. There is a way that it's organized. But he certainly, what you see is not what holds up the building. But as I said, that was always true in architecture. So he's not breaking the rules of architecture. He's just breaking that modernistic rule, which believed that if you design something true to its form, it would be beautiful. And we know that's simply not true. And even Mies, a great architect, knew that. So his buildings are full of subterfuge. Frank Lloyd Wright, his buildings often have steel beams that are hidden in there. You can't see them. Those roofs that sort of float effortlessly are supported by steel beams, but the beams are hidden. So the roof seems to support itself, and it has this sort of light quality. So I think even modernists didn't actually follow those rules. Corbusier didn't ever follow that rule. His buildings have a lot of structure that's not real structure, and real structure that you can't see. And because I think they all understood it's the experience of the building that we have that's the important thing, and that these kind of moralistic rules is not what makes great architecture. It's really more the imagination of the architect and ultimately our experience of the architecture.
One last question.
Yes.
Your comments about the cupola and as the high point in buildings, the central focus of buildings, I found very interesting. Your picture of McGill, the arts building with the cupola, you forgot to mention that the flag is a very important feature. In fact, in your picture, I think the flag was at half mast. And I think as professors come up the campus alley, they often looked at the flag mast to see if the flag's at half mast, if one of their colleagues has passed away. I think that the cupola allowed in many great buildings a connection with the city by allowing the public to walk upstairs and get up to the cupola and look out over the entire city, which is really quite special. In the 19th century, some scientists decided that they could actually introduce what is called a camera obscura to allow people not to have to climb up, but to, in fact, look at an image of the whole city at the ground floor level of the building by using mirrors and bringing an image down before the invention of photography.
I think I agree with your interesting points. I think the flagpole is a good point in the sense that what you put on top of a building is very important. You know, it could be a flagpole, it could be a cross in the case of the churches, but it's a sort of moment in the building that's very crucial that those architects all understood. And so the opportunity, or even the opportunity to have a clock on the cupola is important because especially in those days, people, of course, didn't have watches. But so it's a moment in a building that's kind of a unique moment of what happens at the very top of a building. One of the sad things with skyscraper design, that postmodernism tried to make skyscrapers that were as good as the skyscrapers of the 30s, but never quite succeeded, 20s, 30s. But the modern skyscrapers, there's a trend now to put masts on buildings, but it's a very ineffectual termination. The Freedom Tower at the World Trade Center has cut off, and then there's a mast, and the New York Times building has a mast. They're not radio masts, and the New York Times building is a sculptural mast, but it doesn't feel like a satisfactory way of topping a building. I'm not sure what it is. I'm more and more of the sense that the 1920s, it was like Mozart. We got really lucky, and some incredibly good architects figured out how to make these Empire State Buildings just the most evocative buildings possible, and that we've never really recovered the ability to do that since. And maybe it is like Mozart. We don't moan about where's the next Mozart coming from. I mean, we're lucky to have one, and that's it. And with skyscrapers, I have a bit that feeling. I've never seen a skyscraper as good as the RCA building or the Chrysler building or the New York or the Empire State Building. They sort of get everything right. There's sort of a little bit of detail that's interesting to look at. There's that great landmark that you see on the skyline. I mean, undoubtedly, somebody someday is going to figure that out. But it's without direct copying, which wouldn't necessarily be so satisfying, it's hard to quite see what that... Even Gary, who's done a couple of skyscrapers, hasn't quite solved that particular problem. Thank you.
What a wonderful discourse. I have been fortunate enough to be associated with Witold, first as a student, colleague, friend, a co-builder. And over the years, what I have experienced is his insight into architecture and the civic side of architecture, what makes cities and our living in the cities most enjoyable, and how can it be refined further and further, and how can we, as citizens, as practitioners, as ordinary people, or as architects, play an important role in capturing back the moment that he describes in these great skyscrapers or great civic buildings he described. But that insight's getting better and better, like even in his emeritus position, like good wine, it gets, as it matures, it brings in all kinds of insights which otherwise wouldn't come out. And Vitor, I very much appreciate that, and there are many more insights still to come, and thank you very much. I hope you people will join me. The